it does give you an idea of how, you know, how writers were thinking at the time, which is like, no, read me four times. You know, Joyce himself said that his ideal reader was someone who would have kind of perpetual insomnia, and they would read his books, you know, their entire lives, and then just read them all over again. He wanted to make a piece of art that could just, that could last. You could read it your entire life and find something new with it. And so on the one hand, a bit of an arrogant ambition. And on the other hand, if you can pull that off, people will absolutely do it. And there is mountains of Joyce scholarship and Eliot scholarship and Faulkner scholarship and Proust and all these different people. I mean, if you get into it, it will absolutely obsess you.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Matt Hansen. He writes for American Purpose, The Arts Views, Boston's online independent arts and culture magazine, and a couple of other journals and magazines, including The New Yorker. He has joined me today to talk about modernity, James Joyce, and T.S. Eliot, because 2022 marks the 100th anniversary of Ulysses, as well as of T.S. Eliot's The Waste Land, and we'll have to celebrate that. So welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
You are in another part of the world. You just told me that you are sitting in New Orleans, and I am in Norway. So tell me just a little bit about what you're doing. And the listeners here knows that you are writing articles in very good magazines, and they're all about culture and literature.
Yeah, that's something I'm really passionate about. So I live in New Orleans. I've been here for a couple of years. Absolutely love it. I'm originally from New England. And the thing I'm most interested in right now is I'm really interested in literature and pop culture as applied to sort of a social criticism, and how, you know, these different artists talk about their responses to their times and to the issues that they're dealing with, and how that relates to now. It's something I'm really interested in, how history kind of repeats itself in a certain sense, and how artists teach us about that.
Well, we'll see if some of these artists that we're going to talk about today repeat themselves or what we can say about them. But to begin with, what is your idea of modernity?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and kind of complex question, and the definition can get kind of slippery. The way I think about it is, essentially, modernism is, for me, it's got to be about the 20s, the 1910s, 20s, 30s era especially, which has to be a response to, I think, fundamentally two things. The effect of World War I and the trauma, the collective trauma that especially Europe was dealing with at the time, where, I mean, the old aristocratic orders were shattered. There were so many just, you know, wounded and dead and suffering people. And that after a huge collective experience like that, you can't look at the world the same way. The world is going to just feel differently, sound differently, and just the way you think about things is going to be forever altered. The second thing I think that really plays a big role in modernism is the proliferation of different technologies and different media. So you had the radio, and you had, you know, music and different things that were popular, but right around that time you start to have mass communication, and you really start to hear, you hear the radio more often, movies start to become a little bit more commonplace. They're still kind of basic, but they become a bigger part of people's lives. And so the idea of text and the shared text that people used to have, the Bible or popular literature, it starts to sort of change and fragment. You know, people's sense of attention span start to change a little bit. I mean, just a few years prior in the Victorian era, you would have, you know, whole families sitting around the table by candlelight reading Dickens to each other, and or George Eliot or something. And it's a really beautiful thing. There's nothing wrong with that at all. I mean, I kind of wish we were still, you know, living in a time period where we did that. But instead of it being one big text that you would bring home and read and that would be your entire time, you have all this other stuff competing for your attention. And 100 years later, we totally, right, know what that feels like. And so I think the modernist writers, particularly people like Joyce and Eliot, really anticipated that attention deficit that we have now when they were just, I mean, you know, when everything was that much more rudimentary. I think that was very prophetic in a way.
Yeah. And so when we say 1922, we cannot just say that that is the year when modernity started, even though we try to to say, of course, that this anniversary is worth mentioning because it's about Ulysses and it's about the wasteland. And, you know, those are two huge, huge literary, well, not exceptions, but really they are standing up there as some literary towers in a way. It's people know what they are. So, well, we are just celebrating that because you have described it as a modern turn. And in your text about these two texts, both authors took full advantage of, as you say, the high modern assertion of an artist's rights not to make it easy for the audience. So, why would making something very difficult be modern?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to how much the artist feels indebted to the audience. Am I here to please the audience and to keep them, you know, enthralled and to keep them buying the next issue, right, of my serialized novel to find out what happens next? There's nothing wrong with that at all. Lots of amazing literature has come from that. And I really kind of wish we still had serialized novels where it was a new chapter every month. That's a really fascinating way, you know, to write literature. I think with the modernists, they decided, and I think part of it was the impact of the war and the new sort of media, was to say, no, the writer is the one in charge. It's my world, and you're just experiencing it. And, you know, I don't need to cater to you, the mass audience, to please you and to flatter you and to make you feel like, you know, you're part of the action. I think a lot of the modernists, and there's some tradition that they're working from in that respect. But I think the modernists especially were like, look, the world doesn't look the way it used to, right? And things are kind of falling apart. And so I have something that I want to share with you, the reader, but you have to meet me where I want you to go, right? You have to meet me on my terms. There's a famous quote from William Faulkner, who I adore, and who was very much involved with Joyce and Eliot in terms of as a reader. He didn't know them personally, but he was definitely attentive to what they were doing. And anyway, William Faulkner was at, and his works are notoriously difficult to read. A lot of it goes over my head, even though I really like his work. And he went to a college reading, and one of the was taking questions, and one of the students said, you know, Mr. Faulkner, I'm really interested in your work, but I've read this paragraph or this sentence three times, and I don't really know what it means. You know, can you help me? It's a perfectly legitimate question. And Faulkner said, read it four times. You know, and so on one level, right, that's kind of arrogant and kind of snobby, and I don't blame anyone for being turned off by that. I completely get that. But it does give you an idea of how, you know, how writers were thinking at the time, which is like, no, read me four times. You know, Joyce himself said that his ideal reader was someone who would have kind of perpetual insomnia, and they would read his books, you know, their entire lives, and then just read them all over again. He wanted to make a piece of art that could last. You could read it your entire life and find something new with it. And so on the one hand, a bit of an arrogant ambition. And on the other hand, if you can pull that off, people will absolutely do it. And there is mountains of Joyce scholarship and Eliot scholarship and Faulkner scholarship and Proust and all these different people. I mean, if you get into it, it will absolutely obsess you.
Yeah, and if we just say what is exactly so modern about these two books, and especially probably Ulysses as a book and the other as a poem, and you mentioned a few things and you're saying it right here in sort of way that it's about how they put together the text itself, how they just like find new words, change spellings, just writing, you know, in a very different way, and maybe for people that were used to reading novels coming a chapter every month. This was a text that were, as you just said, maybe for some completely well, not Greek in a way because it's English, but you know, it's not to be understood. So, what is it about those two books, especially?
Yeah, I think it's, and this goes into the idea of challenging tradition. I mean, this was a learn the rules so that you can break them for both of these guys. They had come up, both of them had come up in the literary world, writing in traditional forms and doing a really wonderful job with it. I mean, James Joyce's Dubliners, the short story collection, is very, very much about realism. It's not hard to follow. It is just absolutely what these people's lives are like. Actually, he took a big cue from the famous Norwegian playwright, Ibsen.
Yeah.
He was a very, very devout Ibsen fan because he appreciated the realism and the challenge to, you know, conventional thinking that that kind of realism brought. And so, and Eliot was writing all these sonnets and these really interesting verse forms. So with Ulysses in the Wasteland, they're taking an axe to the standard ways that you think of a novel and you think of a poem. And they're saying, no, you don't have to think about a novel or a poem in a traditional way anymore. Right. This is what we can do with it. This is what the novel and the poem can be. And so it's this step. It's this big step forward. I always think of Ulysses specifically as kind of extremely realism because it's not a third person. Right. Matt Hansen walked down the street and he looked in the window and he went into a store and he bought something. It's in the mind of the character. Right. We experience reality largely through our own minds, through our consciousness. And of course, if you were to overhear someone's thoughts throughout the day, it would be this kind of, you know, jumbled mess, right? But it would also be the jumbled mess that you live in every day, that you inhabit. And so I feel like with Ulysses, he was like, no, I'm going to take realism to the nth degree, right? We're going to overhear this person's thinking. And with Eliot, I think he decided that a poem could include not just the usual verse structures like a sonnet or a villanelle or whatever, but he could also include sounds and overheard conversations and the singing of birds and droplets of water. And so now that a poem can contain this, right, we can't think about poetry in the same way.
Yeah. So for the listeners here, Ulysses is not an easy piece of literature, and we won't even talk about Finnegan's Wake because yeah. I know because I read an article just a couple of weeks ago that there's a Norwegian he is using, as you said, his whole life to translate Finnegan's Wake into Norwegian, and he still has, I mean, many years ahead of him because he cannot do many pages in a year or so. So, right. Well, let's leave that, and we'll take us through Ulysses and what is it all about? Because the original Odyssey takes many years. I mean, Odysseus, he is going around in his ship with his people in for years and years and years. He's never coming back from Troy. Eventually, he comes back to his island and his kingdom, but it takes many, many years. But whereas Ulysses, it all happens in one day. And I've heard that Joyce himself used about 7 years to write it. So as you said, we might use kind of couple of years at least for repeating it and reading it. But this is just, you know, just the idea of what it is. But what is it exactly that Ulysses is about? What is he doing? And what is this just day? What is it? You can't expect people to read it all through, but I think many listeners might have done it, but some might not have done it. So go through it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and again, you know, no scolding or or judgment if people can't get through it. You know, it's not everybody's cup of tea. If people get a little intimidated and they think of it as like this big book and, you know, and if you don't get into it, that's entirely your right as a reader. Right. So basically Ulysses is set on one day, June 16th, and which has now been known as Bloom's Day. It's worldwide celebrations. And the story is largely the story of a man named Leopold Bloom. He is a Dubliner, and he's an advertising canvasser. He puts advertisements in the newspaper, and he is going about his day. He makes breakfast. He goes to work. He walks through a lot. He walks through the library. He's concerned. So it's kind of funny because the reference to Ulysses is this man, he's wandering throughout the earth and he encounters all these mythological creatures and he has these great adventures. And what I think is kind of charming about it is that Leopold Bloom doesn't really do anything all that dramatic in his day, right? He eats his lunch, and he worries about, and what's funny also is that with the Odyssey, Odysseus, or Ulysses, if you want to use the Roman term, but Odysseus is trying to get back to Ithaca, to his home, right? To his wife Penelope and his kingdom and his son Telemachus. And so Penelope is holding off these suitors, right, who are trying to take over everything. And she's being faithful to him as he goes out wandering. In Ulysses, poor Leopold is walking around worrying about his wife's infidelity. Which he knows is going. It's this interesting thing where like he kind of knows it's going on, but he doesn't want to say anything about it. And she's going to have an affair with Blazes Boylan, who's this kind of like charming, kind of ne'er-do-well scoundrel. And so in the modern version, his wife is actually straight up cheating on him, which is kind of an interesting twist on that. And the thing with Leopold Bloom, and I talk about this in the piece, is that he's an ordinary man, but he is extraordinary in his ordinariness. He doesn't do anything terribly heroic. He's not dashing. He's not brilliant. He's not, but he has this sensitivity. He is alive. He's awake. He's paying attention to the world around him. And he's sweet-natured. And he's not a boring character in the sense that, I'm going to give you somebody boring and just like dare you to read it. He's somebody who is more interesting the more time you spend in his head and just observing his life. And he's got a sense of humor and he has this kind of, I don't want to say romantic in the kind of dashing way, but his memories of his wife when they first, got married, when he proposes to her, kind of recur in his mind throughout the day. He's a loving person. And Telemachus in the Odyssey is Odysseus's long lost son. In Ulysses, he is sort of symbolically reunited with his long lost son, whose name is Stephen Dedalus, who appeared in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. This is kind of where Dedalus goes after the end of that book. And they don't know each other, but they end up interacting and kind of meeting each other, and he takes him home for cocoa, and there's something at the end of the night, they get drunk together, and there's this sort of a father-son meeting that some commenters have made a big deal out of, and there's definitely plenty of symbolism in that. And so it's the sense that you are privy to the thoughts and memories and interests and curiosities and insecurities of these people. And so it's what makes the book work for me and for the people who love it is that these people really seem to grow on you. You feel like you really know them and that you're engaging with them on this really deep level. And I find that very exciting. And so to make that, to make a story about average people into this kind of, grand story is very exciting and very moving and very sweet in a certain way.
So we can actually say that even though the title of the book, Ulysses, is the same as the Odyssey, well, it's about the same kind of principles going on here, but it's actually more or less the opposite thing. It's really short. It's just one day. And as you said, this Leopold Bloom, compared to Ulysses, they are just on the opposite side. Ulysses is, intelligent, shrewd and everything. And he, in all these years, he has a lot of experiences that are really, as you say, mythological. And it's fantastic what he's experiencing, whereas this other person here is the complete opposite. And that is maybe for something that's supposed to be in the beginning of modernity, grabbing, a title and also the chapters and everything and just turning 2,000 years back or even more. to 2,000, even more, to 500 years back, to get the title of another literary huge thing, the Homeric poems. So why do you think that James Joyce wanted to do that? Has he just, you know, recreated something that's more than 2,500 years old and made it modern?
Yeah, I mean, the story apparently came from Ulysses. Originally was just a short story idea that he had for Dubliners. It was just, I'll just have this guy walk through Dublin and all the things that happen in the Odyssey will kind of happen to him in sort of a fun symbolic way. And he just thought it was going to be, I guess, sort of just like a fun idea. And then little by little, he was like, oh, my God, I can put more into this and more into this. And what if I do this? And maximalism, right? I want to always add more to my story, to my text, to my language, which, again, is, I think, in some ways very modern, right? Just put it all in, everything you're experiencing. And so and I think part of it is it's a work of imagination. I mean, you know, when at one point Bloom goes to a funeral and it's the Hades episode. They call them episodes. And so, you know, he's walking around and you hear the story about, you know, Patty Dignam and what his life was like and how everybody kind of responds to him. And so in another scene, there's the Cyclops when Odysseus goes to the den of the Cyclops, the one-eyed Cyclops. He has a run-in with a anti-Semitic lout at a bar. Bloom's half Jewish. His father was Jewish. His mother was Irish. When Cyclops throws a rock at Odysseus, this is a biscuit tin that gets thrown at at Bloom. There's the sirens so the idea of the mythology, I think what Joyce wanted us to do is to be able to say, look, like, you may not think that your life, your very realistic, you know, muddled life is all that interesting or exciting, but it is. And there's an imagination to it that you can apply that could be very easily connected to, you know, some of the great myths of human civilization. And I think Joyce really felt that. I think he believed that people's lives were more artistically compelling and complex than they'd been given credit for, than people kind of notice, you know? And so when he gives you these characters, he's not just telling you what they do, he's telling you what they think, and then he's giving you sort of just as they're figuring out their lives moment to moment in terms of, you know, what do I want to eat for lunch, or, you know, do I still love my husband, right? The little questions and the big questions. I think he's asking you to do the same. I think he's asking you to live as fully as possible. Through, you know, figuring out your life moment to moment, the way that these characters do.
Mm. So we can do the same thing with T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. Reading it, I found at my edition there that the notes and comments to the poem is almost as long as the poem itself, even though the poem in itself is quite long to be a poem. But anyway, half of the text were just, you know, notes about the different things going on there. So what is that about?
The notes or
no,
just the
poems? I mean the wasteland, what is he writing about?
Yeah, yeah. So the wasteland, I think, and I try to contrast this in the piece with Ulysses, because I see Ulysses as the book of life, right? It's the book of the day. We take a lot of attention into the sensual details of the, you know, the breeze on your shoulders or the, you know, the color of the mustard on your sandwich. With the wasteland, it's the book of the night. It's the poem of mourning and of darkness and of sort of regret and the end of civilization. The way that it feels like you aren't sure where you are anymore, and you're not sure how much farther you have to go. And I think with the wasteland, you know, Eliot is really, I mean, he's in England, which obviously got hit by World War I, you know, as bad as anyone else. And as an American in England, he's very much more attentive to that because it's a new culture for him. And, you know, there's this sense of exhaustion and of weariness. And, you know, the idea of saying that April is the cruelest month I mean, I guess if you want to make that case, right? That I mean, not a lot of people would probably say that. But as I say in the piece, you know, he's letting you know what kind of mentality this poem has right off the bat. And the other idea I think that Eliot is playing with, which is also very Joycean in the sense of applying mythology and other texts to you know, the modern world. And it's interesting because Joyce and Eliot did know each other, and Eliot really admired Ulysses, and he liked the idea of applying mythology to the modern life. But for him, it's the ruins of civilization. You know, it's we thought that we had these hierarchies and these structures, and everything was well put together, and the whole world has just torn itself to shreds. You know, especially with modern technology. You know, other wars were a little bit. I mean, war is never really civilized, but this was mustard gas and trenches and mud and tanks and death. It was awful. And I think after that, it's like, okay, where's the civilization now, right? Where's our hope? Where are we, how are we supposed to act like everything's going to be okay when, you know, the world has just been completely shattered? And I think with The Wasteland, you know, it has this this power to it because of the depth of horror that Eliot is really contemplating. And it's one thing to be sad and melodramatic and say, oh, my life is over, right? In your poems. We've all done that, right? We've all been through high school and thought that the world was ending because we didn't get a date to the prom or whatever, you know, but this is real despair. This is a real existential break, because Eliot was a very cultivated person. He was very much aware of what was going on around him. And so he can tap in to the history of Western civilization and of Eastern civilization. He's got things from Buddhist scriptures. And so he has all of this in his head. And at the same time, he's looking at a ruined London and a ruined Europe, right? Civilized classical Europe shattered. And because he has that kind of erudition, he has the authority to really speak on how it's fallen mm-hmm. to pieces.
So from what you've just said about both those two works, I think it's obvious that they had to become part of the world literary canon. I mean, Ulysses has even created, as you said, an annual celebration the very day of Ulysses, the 16th of June, which is now called the Bloom's Day. And you are also saying that you're making an interesting observation in The Wasteland, because you say Eliot lived up to the demands that all difficult writers make, and then and now you don't necessarily have to understand everything in a poem like The Wasteland to feel it and to respond to it. So let's talk a little bit about those feelings, because one thing is, of course, after the First World War in 1922, it's obvious that people would feel despair and will have feelings that Eliot was able to put that down into his poem. And but what do you think that contemporary readers might feel about both these two works if we just treat Ulysses as a day, a joy, a more positive kind of work, whereas The Wasteland, something dark and negative? Yeah, would we feel the same thing now?
Yeah, definitely. And I think in some ways, we 100 years, I mean, these guys were geniuses. I mean, 100 years later, we are in both of those places, right? We constantly hear, right? It's funny too, because, you know, this is called modernism, right? And now, obviously, we would be postmodernism, right?
Yeah.
But whatever postmodernism even means anymore, or if we're postmodern, you know. But but we are still, this is, I very much believe that literature and art tap into things that are, you know, perpetually human. Ezra Pound, who knew both Joyce and Eliot well, and who was a complete idiot in many, many ways, did say very beautifully, I think, literature is news that stays news. So in terms of contemporary life, I mean, on the one hand, you have the Joycean sense of everything is at play. All these different texts murmur within each other. And, you know, we are constantly playing with text right now. We've got emojis and GIFs and, you know, Twitter and Facebook and everything. And when you watch TV, there's a little thing crawling underneath the person who's taught, right? And so you're kind of seeing three or four things at once. And that can be very, you know, chaotic and exhausting, but it can also be very fun and very enjoyable and very artistically rich. You know, the idea of play, I think Joyce really, really cared about that. And we also aren't running around, you know, being heroic anymore. We go through our muddle through our little lives. And so I think Joyce gives us a way of looking at our own lives that's more exciting and redeems the everyday. And I think that's really wonderful. And people respond to the book by dressing up like the characters and having a drink at the pub and reading it out loud and, you know, and having and reveling in it. Now, at the same time, we also have, and I mean, I don't want to speak for, you know, every person in 2022, but I feel like there is there not sort of an ambient sense of dread and fear and worry? And, you know, I certainly don't go in for this kind of thinking, but people constantly say things like, are these the end times? And, you know, are we going to have a planet in another 100 years with the way things are going with climate change and pollution and the political situation being a nightmare all over the world? And feeling like, which I think some people have commented on before, feeling like we're at the end of something. We're at the end of a historical cycle or at the end of our belief in rational, you know, humanitarian civilization. And so with Eliot, there's a sense of that anxiety and that despair that I do think people feel right now. I think there's a lot of it going around. People have kind of given up sometimes. I get a sense that people are sort of exhausted and say, oh, to hell with it. And it worries me. And I feel like that, it's interesting how Eliot has reverberated with a lot of readers now, which I just noticed just talking to people that, you know, and with The Wasteland, I've heard a lot of people say that The Wasteland, you know, moves them in a way that they can't quite explain. I talk about it in the article that Ralph Ellison, the great novelist in America, the author of Invisible Man, he was reading The Wasteland in college as a music student. And didn't really even think of himself as literary. And he said, I was moved by its ability to move me without really quite understanding exactly what it was saying. And I treasure that. I really think that's a beautiful thing. And especially for Ellison, you know, as a black man in America, reading that in the 30s and 40s, right? The idea of desolation and despair, it can't be too far away. And I also think that, you know, other Eliot poems tend to be a lot of people's favorite poems. Things like The Hollow Men, which is, again, you know, incredibly sad and moving and evocative. And The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which I've noticed lots and lots of people consider their favorite poem or that they just really feel it. And again, it's the anti-hero. It's this guy who's, you know, he's constantly anxious, self-conscious, you know, there's this famous line, do I dare to eat a peach? Which is kind of funny in a sense, because it's like, oh, get over yourself, eat the peach if you want to, right? But we have a current sense, I think now, in the 21st century of extreme self-consciousness and anxiety. And, you know, it's not about eating a peach, it's about, do I dare to make this particular decision, right? People are very anxious about what the repercussions of their decisions and their actions are going to be. And I think that with Prufrock, Eliot taps into that sense of like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. And I don't know where I want to go. And maybe the grand world that they talk about in books and that, you know, I see in the movies is never going to be my life. And so I think Eliot taps into that sense of the anxiety and the despair that I do think is all over the place right now.
So yeah, because well, let's say that if you are about to read something funny, you should read Joyce, and if you are really despairing, you should read Eliot, or the other way around if you want to change your mind. But it's worth mentioning that is what you write about both of these two authors. They use ancient mythologies, that we have been into that already, in their very modern texts, and you remark that this gives them an extra symbolic depth, and I agree with you. But as you say, people don't seem to do that much anymore. I mean, using old stories and religious stories and mythologies, and in this case, Greek mythologies and Roman, of course, afterwards. Is one also that people don't know history anymore, and or they don't care, or other reasons? Because I think that what you just said about what could be human and what people can experience, mythologies is exactly about that. The stories that you hear about in Ulysses, and also in lots of other things from Greece. It's about how you live and what you should do and what you should not do, what can happen to you, and all those kind of things. And that's why they stay on. But if people don't know it anymore, if that's the reason, is do we have any need for it anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to shake my fist at the idea that people don't know old myths and so forth. I understand that there's more in the world that you will never get to learn about, you know, than you could learn in a lifetime. And I think it's completely understandable that a lot of this stuff has kind of gone by the wayside, because it's hard to keep up with everything that's happening right now. And it's hard to be confident in the conclusions that you draw, even if you do keep up with everything that's happening. And so I don't want to be snobby or disdainful for people not thinking too much about the myths. I do think, though, at the same time, that it is, and there's also a really strong sense, I think, with people now especially, of why do we need the canon? Why do I have to read Shakespeare? Why do I need to know about Homer and so forth? And I think that's a really good impulse, because you should not just assume that what happened before is automatically the truth or something you need to know. And so I respect that kind of independent thinking. And I think it's in many ways, it's a very healthy thing. But at the same time, I very much do think that it's important for us to hold on to those traditions and to those bodies of knowledge, right? I mean, it's not that we have to accept that a book is good simply because it's been around for 2,000 years, or that it's relevant or special. We should challenge whether or not we find this stuff to be relevant to our lives. But you won't know how relevant a myth or an old novel or poem can be to you until you give it a fair hearing, until you open yourself up to it. And so I think with an audience that – I talk about this in the piece a little bit too. It's like with an audience that Joyce and Eliot were writing for in the 20s, there's more of a standard body of knowledge that an educated reader would have. And you would probably already – if you had obviously the time and the education and the money that would create that, which unfortunately generally went to straight white men, right? And luckily, we can recognize that and fight against it now. But, you know, an audience like Joyce and Eliot's would have a little bit more immediate familiarity with some of the references that they're making and the mythological overlay. In Ulysses, for example, Bloom's walking through Dublin and he's trying to remember a snippet of Mozart's Don Giovanni. And it's kind of bothering him. And then he's, you know, and he's like, wait a minute, does it go like this? And then he's trying to get the words right. The way, you know, a song gets stuck in your head throughout the day. And so a reader at the time would definitely immediately say, oh, Don Giovanni, sure. And that would be something that they would very much pick up on. And they would probably know that Don Giovanni is a story of a guy who's got a different woman every night. And, you know, he can't settle down and so on and so forth. And so the idea of his wife cheating on him and that she's going to be an opera singer, the reader would pick up on that a lot more quickly than they would now. And so I'm very much in favor of people hanging on to the knowledge and the stories of the past. And but at the same time, you know, you can't blame anyone for not having the time to sit down and learn all that stuff, because, you know, who can do that while they're trying to fix the toaster, you know?
well, listen to podcasts, maybe. Today, things can be said and written and displayed of almost anything, not like in 1922. And I read something the Irish author Anne Enright wrote about Ulysses, also to celebrate 100 years, that the book was dangerous, voyeuristic, transgressive, exciting, and that her mother didn't let her read it when she was 14 because her mother said it was too dirty. Is it still so, and why?
I think I've read the same piece, actually. And it's funny, too, because an Irish author saying that your mother tells you it's too dirty, Joyce would have had a field day with that, right? That's part of the reason why he wanted to live in he didn't want to live in Ireland, and he wanted to write in this kind of provocative way because he knew those nice Catholic Irish aunties would say, stay away from those dirty books, right? I think it is. I definitely think it is still dirty and still provocative and still edgy because there is a vast array of provocative and whatever dirty things to be found on the internet. not to surprise anyone, but it's right. And so it's because it's endlessly available. I think it matters less to us. I think it's less intriguing because who cares? With Ulysses, it goes places that most books have never dared. And in some cases, I am not for censorship at all, but in some cases I can understand why it freaked people out. There's nothing terribly cruel or vicious or anything, but it's a lot at certain points. There's a visit to a brothel, for example, at the end of the story that becomes totally this like hallucinogenic, phantasmagorical, insane nightmare. And I can see why that ruffles feathers. At the same time, though, Joyce was very adamant in saying that if Ulysses isn't fit to read, then life isn't fit to live. Because let's face it, we have bodies, right? We are spend lots of our time upkeeping, with the upkeep of our body or, our senses. And so Ulysses is a book that is very, very, very alive to the senses, right? Smells and touch and taste. And, sometimes that becomes erotic, right? Or it becomes, quote unquote, dirty. I mean, how many characters can you think of that go to the bathroom during the course of a book? Very rare, right?
Yeah.
And if it happens, it's usually this comic thing where it's overdone, whatever, it's kind of played out.
We have a Norwegian now, the one that wrote might mean Kamp, which is, well, that's in Norwegian, but so he wrote about those things and right. He got reactions.
Exactly. And, again, I feel like this is in the tradition of realism. I mean, we all go to the bathroom, right? And we do it every day. Why can't this be the kind of topic that we can have in literature, right? For just one example. I mean, that's I think an argument that Ulysses makes, right? It's like, why can't we talk frankly about these things? And the sexuality in Ulysses is very frank and kind of blunt and also kind of fun and very vivid. And it's not, when it was put on trial for obscenity, the judge who had to read it, said, yes, it is kind of gross. I mean, I'm paraphrasing what he said. He's like, yes, it's kind of gross at times because, it is kind of gross at times because life is kind of gross at times. But it's not done to be perverse and it's not done to creep the reader out, I don't think. It's done because that's another part of life. Everything is in Ulysses. Life, death, love, hate, the highest of highbrow, the lowest of lowbrow, And so that is a part of that, so anything that's shocking or erotic or, slightly vulgar is fair game in Joyce's mind because that is also a part of our life. And I think even now, it's not... Even though the internet has, anything you could possibly want, there's just not, it's not treated with the exactitude and the attentiveness that a real writer would put into it, right?
Yeah.
Like somebody like Nausgaard, who I haven't read him, but I've heard that, you know, we'll talk about every single cornflake in his cereal, right?
Yeah.
And with that kind of attentiveness, you know, you get into art. And then it's like, all right, well, now we're speaking frankly about the things that make us human.
Yeah, and we are both agreeing here that when it becomes literature, even 100 years between Joyce and Knausgaard, you still have those same reactions to these things, even though they are completely normal. Because as you say, we are now living in a post-modern world, or yes, you said post, we don't
right,
know exactly,
whatever
it does.
Iteration of post, yeah.
Well, I cannot tell. Maybe you can, but
I have no idea either.
It's full of social media and electronic books. And do you think that these two works would have been published today if they had the chance? I mean, both of them, Ulysses and Eliot's poem.
I think that they would be published today. I think they could be published and they could be read. Because I mean, it's kind of hard to define, but I mean, some people are just that good. Some people are just that talented. And I think Joyce and Eliot are just that great of writers. But at the same time, I don't think that they would have had the cult followings that they have and the reputation that they have and the readership that they have, because we are now walking down the path that those pieces of literature paved, right? That the trail that they created, the vision that they have, is something that we've been working with for the next 100 years after they were published. So they would come out now, but they wouldn't have the same effect or the same, you know, reverberations that they did in their own time.
Yeah, and to follow up that, do you think that they would stand the chance to last for another 100 years? And then, of course, will any book written today do that? And if so, which ones?
Yeah, I mean, so first thing I would like to say about that is I saw this interview with Gore Vidal once, and they asked him a similar question. They said, you know, where are the great novels, right? Where's your Ulysses or your Moby Dick or whatever? And he said, you know, I don't worry so much about where will the great writers come from, because you're always going to have people who are just gifted. I'm worried about where are the readers, you know, and I'm not that concerned that we won't have readers, but I really hope that literary culture is still something that people have in 100 years, and that it's still something that people believe in, because of the mass distractions of the internet and, you know, everything else being so much more immediate. So I'm just hoping that we still have the readership for anything in 100 years. And I think we will. It's something I am concerned about. But I think that they will definitely be read in 100 years. And I definitely think they will be inspirational to other artists 100 years hence. Because I think it's about tone, ultimately. You know, Maya Angelou said something I think is really interesting, which is, she says, for what it's worth, she says, people will forget what you said and people will forget what you did, but they will never forget how you made them feel. And I think there's some wisdom in that. You know, you can't always remember what someone tells you, or, you know, you can't remember the text of a conversation. You can't always remember what someone did, but that tone, you know, the vibe, the feeling that you have from that person or that conversation or that moment in your life, and indeed from a movie or from a book or a piece of music, you remember how it made you feel. And I think with what Joyce and Eliot were really able to do was to create that kind of tone and to create that voice that reverberates and that lasts. And I think that's the kind of thing that will never go away.
So you think it's really worth celebrating these 100 years then?
Oh, very much so. Absolutely.
So, and last thing, if there are any books that you have read recently that you could recommend to our listeners, this is we are talking now by the end of the summer holiday, so people might have some weeks to go to read something. Do you have something in mind?
That's a really interesting question.
Something that you like.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, there was this So number one, I think that you can never really predict, I think, what's going to be around in 100 years or what's going to last. I think people will choose that in the future. So obviously, it's kind of a silly, it's silly for me to even presume to think that I could, that I could do that. But I do think that there was a book by Viet Thanh Nguyen, a Vietnamese American writer, and it was called The Sympathizer. And it's basically a reimagination of expatriate Vietnamese Americans, and a guy who's sort of on both sides of the fence in terms of being American, being Vietnamese, and the ideology and the politics that go into that. And I was just completely blown away by it. I was really struck by it. And I think it was wonderful to have a novel that can critique and can, comment and sort of, reimagine that experience and that relationship. And I think there's a lot of books lately, especially, that have been doing that. A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James, which is set in Jamaica, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, amazing. I was so glad that there was a novel coming from a place as complex and fascinating as Jamaica. The Sellout by Paul Beatty, I think, was an amazing, really hilarious and very morally strong, like cutting book about race in America. And so I think there's a very strong appetite for revisiting. As an American, I know, American literature best, but I think there's a really strong appetite for revisiting some of the assumptions that we have about what it's like to be an American from a non-white male perspective. And I think that's a really wonderful thing. Being a white male myself, I can't possibly, understand exactly what that is from a lived experience, but those stories, I think, are really captivating and really needed right now.
Very good. So the listeners have now got a couple of books that they should look into. And also for you, Matt, they can read your articles about books and literature and, culture and things if they go on to American Purpose. Or you also mentioned you have a website. So before you leave, just tell us what that is.
Yeah, my website is www.hansonmatthew.com. And I've got a pretty big archive of more or less everything I've published before.
Oh, that's great. So thanks a lot for joining me today, Matt, from New Orleans. Is that it?
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's completely different from where I am in Norway. But anyway, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks for listening. And if you like Liberal Halvtime, rate us and recommend us, or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage, www.civita.no. Thanks for listening again, and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.